Hey, this is Ryan Dawson of the ANC Report, the Anti-Neocon Report. I've got a friend on the line, Mr. Mario, Thomas Sowell advocate, very well read. We're going to talk about race and economics and politics and some of the stupidity of leftist collectivism. How you doing, Mario?
Oh, I'm doing outstanding on this wonderful Saturday evening here in Louisiana. Glad to be talking with a longtime friend with whom I've been acquainted with, Ryan Dawson. It's funny, I discovered Ryan on a podcast and since then made the effort to reach out to him. And unlike many other people, he was easily accessible. So, I mean, here we are today, 3 years later. The irony is he's met my family before he has met me. So, but I'm definitely it's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, well, I was happy to meet your brother when I went to New York. We went and filmed some of the locations where the Mossad's hanging out on 9/11. It's very interesting. I see the Thomas Sowell there in the background.
Yeah.
I know David Cole's a big fan of Thomas Sowell.
Oh, absolutely. The guy is, I know, he's been, to my understanding, he's a conservative guy, and with his witty humor on his social media feeds, he's espoused some humorous strokes in the direction of Dr. Sowell. So that's how I kind of discovered that he had an affinity for his work, just like I do. So,
once I got one of his books, I just started gobbling up the rest. But I want to talk to you first before we get into specifically one of Thomas Sowell's books, Race. Politics and economics, race, economics, and politics, is poverty. Jesus.
Yes.
Yeah, before we get into that, there was an article in the New York Post about a school that is telling white children who are as young as 6 years old that they're born racist and also segregating classes and instilling a sense of guilt into little kids for how they're, you know, for what color they are, basically.
Yeah, yes, it's an article that was just written recently in the New York Post. Fortunately, New York Post is one of the more conservative publications in New York, as opposed to the Daily News and the New York Times. A teacher, I forgot the woman's name, she's of Middle Eastern ancestry too, I believe. She's invoking a system where our teaching kids or the lesson plan, the criteria is white guilt, and kids as young as six are learning this concept and this principle. She's even gone insofar as to segregate students of other ethnicities and other races and granting them special privileges. It is just absolutely disgusting. It goes to show you just the reverse discrimination. See how that paternalism, these people, they claim to fight discrimination, but yet they invoke their own sense of discrimination. And they're totally oblivious to that. They see this as nothing wrong with it.
I mean, I would just call it discrimination rather than reverse discrimination. I think even the term reverse discrimination isn't quite accurate. It's just plain old discrimination. They don't see it.
I
understand what you mean, but yeah.
Yeah, no, you know what? That is absolutely right. It's very ambiguous, and you definitely have to disavow from that because discrimination is discrimination. It shouldn't be. But, I mean, it goes to show you how when we think of discrimination right off the bat immediately, especially in the West, you think of white against black, but there can be discriminations. I always make the point, and well, we'll go into it, is people tend to also discriminate on cultures, and they can be within the same race. Historically, Northern blacks discriminated against Southern blacks. Irish who've been in America for generations discriminated on the Irish who were just coming here. The German Jews who've been here for generations discriminated on the Eastern European Jews. They discriminated on them not because of their race, but because of their culture and customs and where they came from, how they lacked certain things. Exactly. How they lacked the same hygienic standards, work standards. It's the same case with whites. White Northerners discriminated on hillbillies of white Southerners when they were migrating to inner cities for more job opportunities.
Hollywood does that now.
Say again?
Hollywood openly demonizes the South collectively today.
No, yeah, absolutely. Culture, yeah. The depiction of the South or the mishandling of history to usher in certain narratives, yeah, that is very prevalent.
They're just a bunch of cousin fucking racists and things like this.
No, absolutely. And that ties into a myriad of things. Let's say politically, we look at the party system. Now Republicans are seen as Southerners, but historically the South was dominated by the Democratic Party, which was the party of KKK, the party of Jim Crow, the party that wanted to repeal the 14th Amendment, granting equal protection under law, so on and so forth. And now it's kind of been a role reversal in a way. Now, I guess the Republican Party, since the South has a great stronghold in that voting category, they're seen as the dumb Southern idiots.
Yeah, I know. And you're all bigots. And
Yeah.
Trump's a racist. Trump's Hitler, even though Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton supported sanctions on Iraq that killed 100,000 children. Trump's Hitler because it's on Comedy Central.
I always ask people, and the reaction is hilarious. I ask them, have you guys ever looked at Obama or Hillary's voting record on immigration and what they've actually advocated for? And
Yeah.
everyone is dumbfounded. They're totally oblivious.
Did they ask what's a record?
Yeah, that's the thing. You've made this well known throughout your work. And this is the problem with the general American conscience, as you see, is something that I post recently, is that narratives matter more than evidence. Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton have to be the heroes or the saints. Well, Hillary obviously is tainted by a lot of things, so that's why Bernie had a big voting base with a lot of millennials and young voters, even though they themselves, you can look at his voting record, both what he's done and what he wants to advocate for, taxing the rich. Given handouts to Lockheed Martin, the F-16 fighter jet, which was it
Well, the
1.5
F,
trillion?
no. Well, there he did give
F-30.
money for the F-16, but the F-35 was
F-35.
$1.5 trillion. But of course, parts are made in Vermont. It's not just taxing the rich; he's taxing everybody,
No, yeah.
except for those who
Well,
already aren't taxed anyway.
no, absolutely. It affects everyone. That's what people don't understand. But see, that platitude of 1% on taxes, you're going to ask any of these millennials,
You took
has
the
this been.
1% of the 1%, and it, but
You
he.
know, there's so many things we can cut that down. I could take one, for instance, what we regard as the 1%, as you're familiar with Dr. Soul's work, is that nobody, even this quote unquote 1%, a minute percent of people stay within that income bracket over the duration of time.
But with the
That,
statistic,
right?
like if you sold a house or something that year, you're going to be in the upper bracket. For the following year, you won't be because you won't have that.
Exactly.
There are things like that. There is mobility within all these categories. But his foreign policy is what bothers me more, but not as much as Hillary. But I mean, he has one vote he can brag about. He didn't vote for the second Iraq War. Okay, whoop-de-doo. A lot of Democrats didn't. It was an anti-Bush vote. The same guy voted for regime change and boots on the ground in 1998. And from Kosovo to Syria or to Ukraine, he's voted for every single foreign intervention there is. He's voted for sanctions on Libya. He voted for sanctions on Iran. He voted for sanctions on Iraq. He supported the UN sanctions on Iraq. Even after he knew hundreds of thousands of kids were starving to death, he supports drone strikes. And these are very costly, too. You're talking about trillions of
Absolutely.
dollars in these imperial escapades.
I think one imperial drone, imperial, excuse me, one predator drone missiles are is roughly what, about 32 million. I saw the numbers on it a few months back. That's another thing, Ryan. If sincerely, this is what these or anybody who's just economically illiterate, you want to factor in defense spending and how costly it is, just in general, just to have a base, just to have various amounts of resources, and you're voting for somebody who has a long record of expanding that. So how sincerely are you about helping the poor? Or, do you really have an inclination to how prosperity is created, or you're just throwing out slogans that sound good,
Well, it's like the case for the cost of college. College was not always so expensive until the government started guaranteeing student loans, and the Department of Education is making about 65 to 67 billion a year on the spread on college loans. It's a department, like a mafia style department, that is just bleeding dry these kids who want to go to college. And they have inflated prices, and the colleges know this. Well, if you're going to guarantee the the loans, then we're going to raise the price. And that's what happens. And rather than addressing why things cost so much, he's just looking for new places to tax people to subsidize and prop up overpriced industries. Same with healthcare. But I want to bring circle back to this school in New York. What was this teacher doing? Was she segregating the classes? Like, what was she doing exactly?
Yeah, she would segregate parts of the classes, or certain children had different curriculums or were granted certain privileges over others as far as snacks and stuff like that. It was They don't go too much in depth in the article. Yeah. And it's just really just very disgusting. I mean, you don't know the ruinous effects that you're passing on by having that
That's
paternalism.
going to have the opposite effect
No,
as these kids
absolutely.
grow up and realize the truth. I mean, if you're saying, oh, well, you're white, you have white privilege, so you don't get as much of a snack or any snack as these other people, it's pure discrimination. And you're blaming kids for things that happen in history as if it was some genetic disposition of their race rather than specific policies of government.
Well, you know what? You make a great point. You're absolutely right. And I think, and I had a debate with one individual, is that with race, among other things, or intergroup differences in general, that is something that needs to be addressed. Because all too often, people who have such vociferous opinions on race, they look at everything as the zero sum game. They don't look about. I had a debate with a, I'm not going to put the individual's name out. This individual had a doctorate from a historically black college. All across the board, people today are still invoking the legacy of slavery or Jim Crow to discuss negative retrogressing social pathology. But any inquiring history of such totally dismantles that. I'm not by any means advocating for slavery or saying that the institution was wonderful, but to say that slavery is the reason why 70% of black children grow up in single parent homes today is just nonsense. As far back, Dr. Williams' study, Dr. Herbert Gutman's study on the black family, as far back as 1890 up until 1940, less than 10% of black children grew up in single parent homes. There were more black nuclear families than white nuclear families. It's many things, and by invoking the legacy of slavery, for example, it's always a vague assertion. Nothing has to be specific. So I could say,
Well, that's
well, if
also a very specific type of slavery. Slavery existed across the entire world. Everybody has been a slave somewhere. And it was Western culture that ended slavery.
Yes, that is absolutely correct. It was Queen Victoria, after reading Harry Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, she had a personal travail, and that's why the English were the driving force for slavery. People don't understand how drastic of a push that was, that insofar as, let's say, parts in the East, which, as a matter of fact, are still practicing slavery today, right now, like in parts of Benin, Sudan, Nigeria, even in the Middle East, of course. You look at the fact that some of these nations actually held armed conflicts to uphold slavery. The English fought an armed conflict in Sudan in the 1870s. They lost. They came back in the 1890s under Lord Kitchener. There was a young officer in the ranks by the name of Winston Churchill as a drive to end slavery. They made, that's why they had pirates around in the Western Hemisphere and parts of the East. But slavery was still the law of the land in these respected places. But the pirates, or the people exporting them across the different lands, they were dealt harsh penalties. Insofar as they would even, in many documented cases, would throw slaves off not to get caught by these English police.
But rather than accepting that it was Western society, although Western society practiced slavery, they were the ones that ultimately ended the slave trade and forced that globally. And there's no credit given for that. The same with women's suffrage. New Zealand was the first state to have women's suffrage, and that spread throughout Western civilization first before it hit the rest of the world. But for the collectivist liberal, it's the West, or even worse, the whites that cause all of the subjugation of women and the slavery of minorities in the United States, not looking at it globally and not looking at which ideologies and which type of culture. And if you're going to be collectivist, if you're going to be that stupid, then you have to say, well, whites are the ones who ended slavery and ended the and gave women suffrage too. But that
I
doesn't
had a
happen. It's always you're this group is guilty of something that Arabs and Asians and blacks are also guilty of exclusively, as if no one else had slaves, and as if
No,
it's some
absolutely.
genetic disposition to have slaves rather than the specific policies of British, French, and Spanish governments. It wasn't the Irish or the Polish or the Russians coming over and enslaving Africans. It wasn't whites in general. And it was because of government. I mean, that's like blaming Koreans for North Korea and blaming it on their Koreanness rather than the political ideologies. It's some genetic thing. And that's the weirdest part. I mean, you're telling little kids, like, oh, you can't have a snack because you have privilege. That's disgusting.
It really is. We can go through all facets. Even W.E.B. Du Bois, by his own study abroad, when he went across the U.K., he found that the Irish slaves and the condition of the under the treatment of the English, he said they had half the lifespan, excuse me, half the lifespan of black slaves, and they also had significantly less worse living conditions.
Well, that's
I
how it
think.
is now. I mean, have you ever been to the UK? They have to eat British food every day.
Oh, wow, really?
They have to eat British food and they have to live there with British people. It's like hell on earth. They have to hear that horrible accent all the time.
I think the point is, and of course you elaborated on it, is that no group is free from human sin. Is that when, like I said, and that's not just to the confinement of the US or the West, is that people look at discrimination and just think of it as white on black. Even in a group, look at the Chinese who are expelled out of Nigeria for the economic efficiency, or Igbos who were expelled out of northern Nigeria, or the East Indians, or the Syrians, and where they might not, excuse me, not Syrians, Lebanese, of where they migrated to. A lot of middleman minorities ended up on the deep end of malicious behavior. It could be the Chinese throughout Southeast Asia. The Lebanese in parts of Africa and in the West of where they migrated to. So just limiting discrimination to just one group to try to invoke a view, I mean, it totally dismantled in the face of history or anything empirical.
Also, the bigger point is these are not spawned out of genetics. It's
No,
just
absolutely.
ideology. I mean, you have the long time in Europe conflicts between Protestants and Catholics within the same race,
Absolutely.
same language, etc. And Catholic immigrants to the United States, Italians, also Jewish immigrants to the United States, and Irish. And the Irish spoke English too, so it wasn't a language barrier thing. It's just a religious thing or just a cultural thing of how they were treated in Ireland too. You see that all the time, groups facing discrimination, but the point is, it's not a genetic disposition. It's not the fault of everyone that belongs to a category that acted a certain way in history to be feeling guilt for something that was done by people generations ago.
I wanted
Policy of
to.
government. It's
No,
like blaming
absolutely.
Germans right now for World War II or blaming the Allies for World War I. I mean, it's not something people born today did, and it's not a national thing even. It's just a particular policy, a particular point in time, and you have to look at it like that. This collectivist mindset is going to teach these children to be collectivists themselves, and that's actually going to cause more racism because they're going to say, okay, well, if you're going to demonize us for bad things people who look like me did, are you going to give us praise too? Are you going to tally up the number of scientists and inventors or whatever in my category? Because there's no way all of those can possibly be even across the globe. Some are going to have more than others. So are they suddenly superior? And that's even going to change throughout time. Everybody's had their day in the sun, their golden age.
I wanted to add to that with that ideology, and this is very pertinent as to what you said. You read Wealth, Poverty, and Politics. Dr. Soh elaborates on this, is that that's the benefit, well, for them, political leaders, is that groups who are lagging behind globally will often have leaders who will say that your shortcomings are due to the malign actions of others. Even if these groups have coincided well, let's say, for example, political leaders in Czechoslovakia, the Germans historically, and as they moved out east, they dominated the education industry. So for a Czech person to be educated, they had to learn German. Rather than go along with that, you had demagogues invoke negative parts of history between the two, and then which led to violence. You look at the in what's the country? Sri Lanka, the Sinhalese and the Tamil minority. You know, the invocation of political leaders saying, "Well, these people are coming over and taking over, and they're gonna dominate the society, and they're gonna do this and that." When these two groups coincided well, and then you had a clash, a civil war, which was a record amount of deaths. And not as drastic, but we see it in many examples. You know, in the ushering in of the civil rights movement, you had also a civil rights industry, political leaders who invoked the idea that you're forever a victim to the malign actions of others, and that, let's say in this case, blacks are the victim of whites, and that anything you do in life, you're just going to be facing these hurdles, and everything is stacked against you. And that, you know, people who, even to this day, we see the Jesse Williams speech invoke that. The problem with that victimization is that you throw out large norms of history, and secondly, nobody's been successful by telling them that you're worthless, you know?
Well, it inculcates an attitude of entitlement, but there are demonstrable economic statistical differences, on average between blacks and whites in the United States. But what are some other factors if it's not just racism? Why are blacks lagging behind? And also, why are some other minority groups doing so well, like Asian Americans, for example?
Well, then a great question. Let's take, for example, obviously blacks lag behind. Well, not now, but the institution of slavery obviously was a big setback. But even throughout that, the setback and all the atrocious acts of slavery, blacks had well advancements and had achieved things that, as one historian had alluded to, was an economic achievement that was seldom seen. Let's take, for example, before the abolition of slavery, the census of 1850 showed that roughly three-fifths of freed blacks can read or write. Then you go fast forward a few decades later, let's say by 1900, roughly 40 years after the abolition of slavery, for blacks, there was 50% of the black population was literate. And you compare that at the time, let's say for a country like Spain or Romania, who had fully developed language, not even half their population was literate. Another thing I'm going to talk about is successes amongst blacks that are seldom talked about. For prior to any major legislation, i.e., the Brown decision or the Civil Rights Bill, the rate at which black families, the poverty rate amongst black families declined was astronomical. I believe that by 1900, 87% of black families were below the poverty line. Roughly around the 1940s, that number was cut in half. It was cut in half for myriad of reasons. One of them being is that blacks were my overwhelming percent of the black population in the U.S. historically was in the South. As they were moved, the South was a place in general that lagged behind in education, in entrepreneurial
Well,
skills, in infrastructure.
since the Civil War, it wasn't always that way, but they had entire
It
cities
was,
burned to the
it was,
ground.
well, prior to the, well, it goes back historically, because even prior to the Civil War, you look at the entrepreneurs that were alien to that region. The Civil War definitely set back with the devastation from the war. But the
Well,
point to be
it's a
had.
case by case thing because states like Virginia were well advanced more than many northern states, but some of the newer states like Florida was just being populated, and they were, out on the perimeter. Texas example is another example. They were just getting started, and of course, in those areas, there wasn't a lot of economic development. It was, starting over again. But then you had the few base of industries there were from Atlanta to Richmond. Many of those cities were burned down. And then you had carpetbaggers, etc. And so what happens is when an area suffers something like that, the intellectuals that they have and the hard workers and entrepreneurs they have are going to migrate where the money is. So a lot there was a big brain drain from the South where people are immigrating north where they could get jobs. And so that the Civil War hurt the South further in that respect as well.
You're right. There's also another factor, though. You look at the culture of the whites from the South versus the culture from the whites in the North. The people from the UK who migrated to the northern states from a different part of the UK, as opposed to those in the South, they exhibited the patterns of what they called the cracker culture. the aversion to work, the neglect of education, the alcoholism, the promiscuity, the senseless act of violence, the broken English, many of which rubbed off on contemporary blacks today.
You can just say redheads. Just kidding.
But many of that pathology rubbed off on blacks today. Even many, let's say that loud religious oratorical style that many political leaders espouse, that you hear Baptists, that originated from those parts of the UK that the Southerners came from. So this was a place, yes, they had entrepreneurs, but the great bulk of entrepreneurs were people alien to that region. Just like with agriculture, so many advancements in the agriculture were founded in the north, like the cotton gin, for example, being one. Going back to my point, we kind of strayed away. Black success, as more and more blacks were moving out of the south up to the north with better job opportunities, they were catching up to whites as far as years of schooling. I believe by shortly in the period after World War I, the number of black graduates from college, from universities, just skyrocketed. And there's also successes. One of the most phenomenal successes, well, I was going to go into it, but, Northerners came down, missionaries came in to educate newly freed blacks to help them disavow away from that cracker culture. That's what paved the way for Oberlin College. That's what paved the way for Dunbar High School. Dunbar High School was an elite all-black public school in Washington. That is something that's stricken for the record books from those who love to invoke race. Its output back in the late 19th century and the early 20th century was truly remarkable and exceeded what was to come in the centuries after so much advancement had been made and so much legislation. Dunbar High School ushered in the first black who's who in every regard, the first black Supreme Court justice, the first black military general, the first black female to earn a PhD in American University, the gentleman who made the breakthrough in blood and plasma research. It was a school that had limited funding, that didn't have a cafeteria till roughly about its 40th year in existence. And this is just one of the things that led to successes. As Dr. Soul made a key fact that in the mid-90s, Dunbar High School's college graduate output was a fraction of what it had been 60 years earlier. 60 years earlier was in the depths of the Great Depression. So that is a enormous retrogression in that regard, among other things. But
well, so part of the statistics are also, even today, because of basically where they were brought, majority of blacks in America live in the South, and the South as a whole has less industry and wealth than the North and in the far West. And also part of that is just the inflation of money because of the size of population. Usually the larger your population is, the higher the wages are, but also the higher the cost of living is. And they don't factor in the cost of living, and they just look and say, well, this person earns more. But actually that same amount of money in a different area, the gap starts to narrow a lot more. But people are innumerate, just as like illiteracy is not as much of a problem today as innumeracy. They look and say, well, look, this guy in New York City is earning so much more than this guy in Alabama. He's more successful. Not also looking at, yeah, well, it's also $3 for Coca-Cola and things like that. They don't factor in the cost of living and see that these income gaps are not quite as great as people assume. But then you look and say, well, these people in the South, Southern whites or blacks, they're not earning as much. They're not as successful and completely getting in these other numbers.
You're absolutely right. I think geography plays a great factor in income and achievement. You look at, let's say, northern blacks compared to southern whites had on average higher rates of efficiency on standardized testing. Also, they average higher incomes, So that is one of the things that definitely, and as far as age too, the median age per groups, people typically upon the later years in life after X amount of years in the workforce or more education earn more than their younger counterparts. The differential in pay between old and young is wider than that between black and white, but yet you won't say
it's just rural and city also.
Absolutely, rural and city, or even let's say between Hispanics and Asians have a wider gap of income than blacks and whites, and I would highly doubt that is due to a legacy of slavery. So That is a very important factor. It's a plethora
We
of
have to look
things
at
that
how
people.
immigration comes too, because the majority of Asians have at least one bilingual parent, and so you're having a sort of natural filter there of intellectual prowess, where the Japanese or Chinese who coming on their own, not brought to the U.S., but who chose to come to the U.S., have a bit more of motivation and intellectual drive than the common immigrants who were just brought over
And you
and
make a
been
great
here a
point.
longer time.
You made a great point, and I'm going to add to that about genetic. If you look at the success of, let's say, black immigrant groups, i.e., West Indian Americans and people from West African nations, compared to the average American, as of 2 years ago, Nigerian Americans had average higher earnings per household than the average white family. You look at West Indian Americans alongside, they were mostly in New York, alongside ordinary African American students on testing. They were doing much better, higher rates of efficiency. Even though West Indian Americans were the minority of the black population, they were the majority of black-owned businesses. At one
And
time in
it's
New
not
York.
like racists can really distinguish between the two. It's just like looking and say, oh, well, you're a West Indian, you're not. They don't know. So they're facing all the same degree of
The
prejudice
same
and yet
barriers.
succeeding.
Absolutely. You look at New York City, where most West Indians were housed. At one time, in the NYPD, all the senior ranking blacks who are of West Indian ancestry. You look at Nigerian Americans, less than 1% of the black population. Yet, routinely in the past decade, there were 20% or more of Harvard graduating business classes. So clearly, I mean, if you're saying that this is due to if setbacks are due to racism, then you're telling me that racism must take a step back on these groups. Furthermore, look at
Well,
black
what
Americans.
explains, I mean, partially we can explain the income gaps the way we just did, but are there any policies from government that are actually trying to subsidize failure?
I like how you put it so blatant.
Yeah.
Sure.
Answer what I said. No, I mean, give some examples though, because
Oh,
that's something
wow.
people would say is, well, like you mentioned, there are more broken homes now than in the past. It would seem like as you get closer to the era of slavery, things would get worse and improve over time, but they got better and then dropped down again. So what happened?
Well, the government stepped in. This is a sad thing. Again, the war on poverty, that was the beginning of the end. As economists allude to, is that poverty rates were just declining massively prior to any of these programs. That coupled with price and wage controls from the earlier decade, or the decades preceding, I should say, some of these laws were on the book. Let's say welfare, for example. It was around in the 1930s, but it was nowhere near as expansive as it is today. Dr. Williams detailed that in his film. What is it called? I believe it's Good Intentions. Dr. Williams, he's in his 80s now. He grew up in North Philadelphia in the 1940s, and like he noted, single parenthood was nothing like it is today, and so was the welfare state. He was one of the few. His father deserted him. His mother was on and off welfare in times when she couldn't find work, but it was nowhere near like today. Labor unions with their exclusionary policies, that's one thing. That's a facet that usually eludes the minds of those who seem to be champions of the poor. Blacks were very well represented in the Jim Crow South and in the early 20th century in many highly skilled occupations, much more than in years to come, because those industries were not unionized. They didn't have exclusionary powers. They didn't administer price and wage controls. So blacks weren't just participants in many cases. They were entrepreneurs in these regards. But the more exclusionary, and this is not just for blacks, it's other immigrant groups. You could say, for example, the taxi industry. For an Italian immigrant in the 1920s to start his own taxi, it was easier. Now, in the late in the years to come, you had the incumbent occupiers start administering laws or programs as prerequisites, i.e., language tests and stuff like that have really nothing at all to do with the trade. And
Well, the
these are us
regulation
traditional.
on how they can get a car because it's not theirs. All the regulations on the taxi industry is why we have Uber
Oh, absolutely. And you see what's going on with Uber and then the
or
scrutiny they're
Lyft.
facing.
And leftists hate Uber. I'm like, why? Why would you? This allows people to anyone basically with a car to earn some extra money.
And not only that, it helps people of low income backgrounds. It's more cost efficient. You know, you can get around where you need, as opposed to the normal taxi services that have to go through all the licensing, who charge higher prices because they have to pay all these senseless fees to get administered. Dr. Williams used the example. Look at a place like DC, a place that has such minimal taxi licensing laws. I believe it's only, like, at the time of this study back in 82, it was like $50 a year, but that was it. And you see places like New York and Philadelphia where you're literally putting almost the payment of a mortgage just to obtain a medallion. And you look at the rates. He says 70% of black drivers in D.C. own their cabs, as opposed to 10% in places like New York and Philadelphia. Now, by any means, he's not saying these occupations were a panacea, but it was a good way. It was people from all walks of life, college students, people working another job were able to obtain a taxi and provide a service at cost efficiency.
And now they can't.
Now they can't.
And they're trying to regulate Lyft and Uber and the alternatives to make them just as bad as taxis.
Yeah. But you and I both know, Ryan, it's to protect the consumers. Isn't that right?
No, it's not to protect the consumers. Oh, that's the line. But, you know, of course not. I mean, it's just a way for parasites to take a successful industry and suck the wealth out of it.
Mm-hmm.
All under the guise of, you know, helping the consumers. It just isn't so.
We talked about taxi, but we kind of strayed away.
Single parent homes. I mean, isn't welfare good for single moms?
Because it's not, because it may help them financially, but it insulates people from some basic civility. You know, you see the single motherhood rate amongst any group, especially for blacks, has been devastating. It's just been on the decline since these programs been implemented, or they were there, but it wasn't as expansive. It didn't have wider powers as the years to come. More and more kids were just born out of wedlock in record numbers. The dad got replaced with a paycheck for government. And people don't understand the ruinous effects that pass off. Every child psychology
that
study...
That would affect the poor of other groups as well.
Absolutely.
And did.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It did. No, definitely.
But there's a different social stigma, because when you are raising a group with a sense of entitlement, they're like, for poor whites, there's a stigma about being on welfare. It's, oh, your dad or your mom's on welfare, and it's kind of shameful a little bit. They try and work five jobs and rather than be on welfare. But if you're in a group that feels entitled, it's like, yeah, I'm on welfare, I'm getting my shit, like, they owe me, you owe me, you owe me this. And I don't think they're as motivated to get off welfare as the poor whites in the same situation, because they have a sense of shame for collecting from government. You see a lot of Republicans, which are a lot of poor people, saying, I'm not taking welfare, you know, I'm working, I'm doing this job. A lot of poor people are the ones with four or five jobs. It's always the guy with four or five jobs who's poor, as opposed to one good job.
No, and you know, that's one of the fallacies with the welfare state, is that through government mingling in the marketplace, you make it harder for people to engage in capital, and you lessen the barrier between well-off and poor. That you have people, let's say, for example, who are on government handouts, government subsidies, that earn a lot more than if they were to entry-level position or engaging in the workforce. So, I mean, what are you going to choose? Someone who's going to have to work 8 to 10 hours a day, or someone who may not have to do much, you know, to gain these handouts or these amenities?
We also have a big gamble in the case where it doesn't work out and you have to fire somebody. You might have to deal with these minority group advocates that make it too costly. I'm talking about, like, for teaching professions and things like this, where they just don't want to have the gamble.
You're absolutely right. That's one of the counterproductive trends of affirmative action in the marketplace. As Dr. Soule, that great debate that you've seen, and he elaborates on in his work, is that, and this is not just peculiar to minority groups in the U.S., this is around the world, is that a kid, let's say a young kid in the South Bronx who is just starting out, he may not have a great work ethic, he may not be punctual, et cetera, et cetera. it'd be costly for that employer to hire him, because to fire him, he would have to be drugged through the court from the EEOC, the NAACP, and all these organizations. So a mediocre or worse white is easier to hire than it is that young black or Hispanic youth who has the stigma of discrimination lingering. So that resulted in those blacks in the U.S., those blacks who are not well off to do, lagging further behind. But yet those blacks who had doctorates or who had X amount of years in the workforce or were well college educated did better off because they were safe. So an employer would go to that quota and say, well, this guy is safe, as opposed to one who's still not there yet.
Wouldn't affirmative action also undermine a person's merit? I mean, even if they were perfectly qualified, it may be the case that you can't tell the difference between a qualified person and somebody who is just the best in their category. And so people will always wonder, or they'll carry that stigma of like, did I earn this, or was I given this just because I belong to this certain group? And then those who don't belong to that group, especially those who didn't get that job or didn't get into that school, it's going to actually harness hatred toward those groups, because they feel like, well, just because I wasn't in this category, I couldn't get into school or couldn't get this job. And that may be true in some of those cases. They may have gotten in that school were it not for affirmative action, which is just trying to fix discrimination with a different kind of discrimination.
It's not only that. I mean, it also hurts, as you say, groups who were deserving. Let's say, for example, Asian Americans. Asian Americans was always made up a great bulk of freshman classes for Ivy League schools. Well, their numbers had to be subtracted, not because they weren't qualified, but because of past discriminations on whites and blacks. So blacks were given a spot based on their race. So you can imagine the resentment that group might have had, you know. Furthermore, in the academic world, in schools, I mean, one of the counterproductive trends, as Dr. Sol laments to, is that these schools lowered the standards or gave blacks more IQ, gave them more SAT points when, you know, put them in another tier, echelon that they wouldn't be deserving of. So when they went to MIT on math, even though they may have lowered math scores, they were failing out, where they could have done well at another university. So
right.
At the end of the day,
they could be in the 90th percentile in the country, but they'd still be in the bottom 10% at a place like MIT, which is
correct.
The top 1% in the country. And so
correct.
They could have done very well anywhere else, and they got thrown in over their head and then fail out.
Yes, and it didn't matter whether they graduated or failed. The only thing that matters is if the racial composition matched what the government wanted. So in the end of the day, a program meant to help people, you see how it had these counterproductive effects.
Right. Well, whereas we didn't see the same thing applied to, say, women. And very quickly, with women getting rights to vote and the culture changing and allowing women in the workforce in a broader sense of occupations besides being a teacher or a nurse. Today, women basically do anything, any job, any occupation. There's plenty of female lawyers, writers, etc. Basically, even or slightly more than or slightly less than males, because we didn't have these type of programs saying, well, if you're a girl, you can get in this and get given this, because you've been discriminated against for so long, which women were, obviously.
Absolutely. I think you make a great point, too. I think, as Dr. Sol expresses, that things have changed. And a lot of people attribute a lot of female success to political movements, when in all actuality, see, women are a special case because of the burdens of motherhood. The burdens of biology tend to have these effects. You know, women don't work the same on average.
Oh, I'll just say the wage gap is a myth. I mean, people get paid the same amount for the same job. The thing is, they don't have the same jobs.
I was gonna draw back is that historically, that in as far back as early 20th century, women were very well represented in many highly skilled occupations, doctorates, masters, etc. But as the average age of marriage started decreasing and the average age of childbearing, women have changed in their representation. So, you know, that's one of the
many
factors.
We also have the military and professional sports and other things with larger salaries than average that are shifting that spectrum somewhat, which she also gets ignored. But I was just seeing, I don't want to get into feminism as another can of worms, but What other policies have been, I mean, not just policies, but parenting. I mean, that's got to matter a lot too, because
Well,
you see
I think
Jewish and Asian and white families generally successful, and Puerto Rican, Black, Mexican, not as successful.
there's a great point. I wanted to go back. Well, not go back, but this is one thing I wanted to express, right? A lot of things with like inner city life and counter. Well, first off, you have to address inner city life and the high rates of crime, the high rates of single motherhood, how that affects a populace anywhere in the world, not just for minorities in the United States. And I want to compare and contrast that historically. First off, when I have discussions on people about high crime rates, sometimes they're oblivious or they can't address it because of the sake of group solidarity. They can never admit these stats or these actions that happened. But I use the point is that Dr. Soul and a lot of old timers, I even have old family from New York that agree wholeheartedly that inner city life back in its 1930s, 40s, 50s, even further then, was nothing like today. It wasn't the rampant crime rates. What we had public housing, i.e. the housing projects. It was free of graffiti. It was free of barred windows. It was free from urine-soaked elevators. You were free from children for teenagers who were accosting you or mugging you just to get into your own building. It wasn't peep crime existed, but it was not like today. Soul talked about the Harlem in the 1940s. People slept on park benches, fire escapes. White celebrities frequented these neighborhoods, often driving their luxury cars there, or sometimes going out intoxicated, wanting to hail a cab with no fear of being mugged or accosted. These housing projects and these housing units were very pristine and well kept and well sought after. People often stayed in. They left the doors unlocked till the last person came home. It was a common practice when televisions came out. Very few people could afford them, but in these housing units, you had a family that had them. They would leave doors unlocked so the children of the adjoining units could come in and watch Saturday morning cartoons. Now today, you have families below the poverty line. The average family below the poverty line has two television sets and cable vision. You would never see that happen in the same environment today. So, I mean, if you're expressing or trying to lament the fact that a lot of inner city retrogressions or you think this is the norm due to racism, then that racism must have skipped quite a few generations because historically this wasn't the case.
Right now, everyone locks their doors, regardless of urban makeup or not. Rural
Absolutely.
areas too. Everybody feels that. Oh, well, if you know, it's kind of your fault if you left your bike in the park, or whatever. Of course, it got stolen because people steal bikes. If you don't lock them, it's your fault for not locking it, and rather than blaming the thief for stealing the bike, you know. And
Absolutely.
crime, people, this sense of entitlement. And it also being a little bit cool, this sort of MTV culture has actually fostered these subcultures where ignorance is praised and theft and crimes are seen as a bit of a badge, like
Absolutely.
this naughty badge or something.
No, you're absolutely. You know, it's funny. I look at hip hop and rap, and you could say, you know, as compared to other genres, hip hop is fairly new. I guess founded in the late 70s, early 80s. But if you look at old hip hop artists, let's say in that era, even though these guys came from low income backgrounds, they still spoke standard English. They didn't give appraisal to senseless violence. There wasn't the misogyny that you're running around. And that's why I laugh. One of the small things of the Jesse Williams rant, he's like, the ghettoization on BET. I mean, you can take a look at the audience. You have Lil Wayne and everyone there. But I mean, who are you going to point to, really? You know, I mean, he's not going to criticize these hip hop artists for doing that because that would infringe on his notion of group solidarity. But you're absolutely right. The culture changed immensely.
When did it
You know, that's
become
one of the things.
cool to not know how to speak properly?
Yeah, when you know not when did it, when are you seen as authentically black by speaking substandard English, you know?
And that it's the crabs in a bucket syndrome. One crab's trying to get out of the bucket, and the ones on the bottom pull them down. People who speak proper English are whitewashed,
Yeah, no,
not keeping
absolutely.
it real. And
And
that's got to stop too. I mean, people dragging each other down.
as painfully visible as it is, you still have people deny that because of group solidarity. But I can draw. I'm not. I don't like using personal examples because it's very anecdotal. But like the basketball player Kareem Abdul-Jabbar talked about it in his memoirs. Growing up in Philadelphia, he was striving academically. He was well-spoken, great academic student. He was bullied and beaten for doing so, you know?
Nobody likes a
And
winner.
yeah. And rather than see this as a standard to achieve, you carry a grievance on your shoulder, you know?
Well, couldn't you do the Bernie Sanders approach and just have the government fix it? I mean, Bernie Sanders came out and said white people should apologize for slavery.
Oh boy. Oh my God, I don't even know where to begin. I mean, even though the percentage of whites who actually own slaves are minute, the affluent whites today, i.e. Jews and other denominations, are really had nothing to do much with slavery. You know, those whites that did own slaves were those that were had the lowest median incomes and also the lowest IQ scores.
Well, there
But
certainly were Jewish slave traders in the transatlantic trade, but it depends where you're talking about. But there were also white slaves traded all throughout the Arab world and Northern Africa too,
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
and
even in
Chinese
America,
slaves and.
there were even in America, there were freed blacks who owned slaves too. I believe it was in Louisiana, one third of freed blacks owned slaves. Some were family members, and some were for hard labor. I mean, another thing too, manumissions. Manumissions was something that local governments were cracking down on. More slaves were relieved through. Oh, excuse me. Were set free through manumissions than the actual abolition of slavery. That's one of the facets that's always missing. Manumissions was the means in which a slave would buy his freedom by working a trade and stuff like that. Which again, this also not giving appraisal to slavery, but led the way for a lot of success stories. Dr. Williams, in his book Race and Economics, in the first chapter, just comes out swinging, talking about like black millionaires in slave states at the height of slavery by getting a trade and providing a good service. There was a former slave who went and practiced medicine, bought his freedom through manumissions, even in this, I forgot which state it was, even where he couldn't practice, for a black to practice medicine was outlawed, but yet the local whites wanted to repeal that because he was so good at his craft.
Yeah, you can see that, but Bernie Sanders is saying white people today have to apologize for slavery. Not that specific era, slavery. It's just ridiculous. It's collectivist. Why don't
Pandering,
we
even after
let's
he
blame
threw himself into the
right-handed
shot.
people for the atomic bombs.
Yeah,
Let's blame people with blue eyes for blah blah blah. I mean, it's just ludicrous. And what, just pandering, that's all that is pandering.
you remember that? I think the most famous one, and I always tease people with it, and he said it, you know what's bad? It's not the fact that they say this, it's a fact that there's an audience that revels in this. And during the primaries, on the campaign trail, during the debates, whites don't know what poverty is, whites are not harassed by police. I mean, anybody that had a simple inquiry could just dismantle that like in 30 seconds. You know, even though there's more whites below the poverty line, even though whites are killed by police double the rates that blacks are and have been for quite a few decades, actually. But, you know, again, this is one of those cases where narratives are more important than evidence.
The white death rate from cops is twice that of blacks per capita.
Yes. Yep, it's been that way since 1989. It's either double or close to it. 1.8. Yeah.
Didn't know that. Well, I guess
CDC
there are more
number.
areas, there are just more areas of poor whites because there are more of them,
Yeah.
probably. All right, well, that's just disgusting. The cops themselves didn't always behave that way either. That's been some government problems. You know, they're getting trained by Israeli security forces, and they're getting all this surplus gear from these ridiculous wars overseas. And the also as part of that Hollywood culture, the police are shoot first and ask questions never. And then the court cases, they're never held accountable for anything that happens. I mean, they're
Know,
killing
this is
people
where,
on film, choking someone to death, and getting
yeah.
acquitted.
This is where I think we're going to clash a little bit. I'm not. You know, I'm not pro cop or anti cop or anything. I agree with you in many regards, absolutely. I think, but what happens when deaths get politicized, people don't ever care about the actual evidence of what happened. The most gross example of that is the Michael Brown incident. You know, that the hands up, don't shoot was based on a lie. Forensic evidence, as well as scores of eyewitnesses, contradict that. But it goes to show you
Yeah, but
before.
like Eric Gardner was choked to death
Oh,
right in
yeah,
front of
no.
us. I mean, there are some clear cases. And what they do is it's the same kind of propaganda they did about waterboarding and torture, right? Torture, there's no excuse for it. So what they do is they go to the extreme end of what's, just between torture, like the most mild forms of torture, and argue about that. Well, is waterboarding torture or not? And ignoring the, drilling into people's knees and organ failure and all the other kinds of torture that the CIA has done in rendition, and they argue about this one case. And that's what they did with the Mr. Brown incident is, well, here's a case that's way more wishy-washy, and ignoring the Eric Gardner or Ayanna Jones, the 7-year-old shot in her house asleep. And like, those are so clear. And nope, don't talk about that. They talk about this other one. But I'm saying, like, if you look at policing around the world, cops in Japan aren't murdering people. Cops in many places are not behaving this way. And cops in the United States did not always behave this way. They lowered the standards. There's actually an IQ cap. If you're too smart, you're not allowed to be a cop. And it's they're getting these aggressive idiots on purpose. And it's really degrading our police force.
But Ryan, you and I both know, I agree with you, but you and I both know there's a myriad of factors. One of those being, as I had mentioned, is the crime rates in inner cities have skyrocketed. It wasn't just to do racist police. There's other factors involved. Obviously, we talked about economic factors. Another thing, Heather McDonald conducted in her study, or Ann Coulter. We can say what you want about Ann Coulter. I know a lot of mainline conservatives, but her book on race was very interesting. But furthermore, you had a lot of leftists that
Who
became
wrote it for her?
paternalistic. Say again?
Who wrote it for her?
You had a lot of leftists who became paternalistic towards criminals. So
Yeah.
rather than lock them up, you had this paternalism towards them. You wanted to understand them. What resulted in New York's, like under Mayor Lindsay in the 1970s, crime started skyrocketing because there was an incentive there, or disincentive, I should say, for these men to do what they do. So you had record amounts of muggings and rapes and robberies, and so that's one of the factors of which the paternalistic view of wanting to feel sorry for criminals, and that's it hurted a lot of people.
Some of it too, because theft is up, but a lot of violent crime is down. It's just the reporting on it is higher. There are more. They report the story more than they did in the past, but actually, there are less shootings now than before.
No, absolutely. Yeah, the
Mass shootings
shooting.
are a particular weird example, but shootings in general, I'm talking about, there are fewer murders, gun, knife, etc., not than in the past.
No, absolutely.
Even though guns are more available. But that's the other thing. I mean, there are at least 11 different countries that do not have the right to bear arms that have double to six times the homicide rate by firearm than the United States. So it's clearly not just a simple case of, well, if you change this one law, everything will change. That just isn't the case. But I wasn't trying to say cops are acting the way they do out of racism. I'm saying cops in general are so aggressive because there are no consequences for their actions.
But
A
then
lot of it's
again,
the drug
too,
war, too.
there are instances where cops are overzealous, absolutely. But then there are well-documented cases where evidence was, or let's say, video in this particular incident, were only showed the tail end. Rodney King is a perfect example of that. We only saw the last few seconds of them beating on him. We didn't see the minutes prior, the chase, or him under the influence of PCP going crazy,
Yeah,
which
but they still beat him when he was down. And it's something that, yeah, that may have been manipulated, but it's something that happened so much that enough people had so many personal experiences with the LAPD that when they saw something like that, it was easy to believe because they behave that way all the time.
No, absolutely.
I mean,
You're absolutely
criminals are
right.
getting drugs in jail. The only way, and it's not all mules with balloons up their butt, the cops are giving them drugs. I mean, our police force is corrupt. There is just no way around it. It's not a few bad apples. It's a few good apples. It is systematically just lost. We've got thugs running the police force. Gang members and everything are involved, just like our government. I mean, nobody is selling more drugs and running more guns to cartels than the State Department, besides maybe the CIA.
You know, that brings a point, is that this is why I'm definitely coming from an urban background. I want to have, I would prefer people, or try to be as persuasive or influential, I should say, is that people from urban inner city environments, like who came from, like myself, is that there's always these narratives always rolling around, and people pontificate a lot of moral indignation, but at the end of the day, they still advocate for more statism, and that's a problem. They don't look at things logically. It's like black or white, rich, poor. They take the zero sum game, and that's why I just want to, you know, that's why I have a disdain for a lot of political movements and political leaders, is just on that. Evidence doesn't matter, it's just good narratives, and that's why Jesse Williams was met with thunderous applause, even though, I mean, you really want to take the analytical approach to everything he was espousing, it wouldn't survive. But
Well, people ought to be asking, compared to what, at what cost?
the murals right here,
Right
compared to
there.
what, at what cost, and what are the cold hard facts? And I don't think people do that anymore.
No,
Like,
it's
what is that?
identity politics now. It's all
What that? Jason Riley had a quote in "Please Stop Helping Us: How Liberals Make It Harder for Blacks to Succeed." To many, it's more important to, they feel that having a black man in the Oval Office is more important than having one in the home. And
I
that
think
was
they
a hard
probably
one.
want both, but that's their intention. I don't think their intention is to screw everything up like that. It's just that they just don't
That's not their
understand. I mean,
intention, but when you really are gratified with identity or imagery, you
they
can
want
take,
that
for
pat
example,
on the head more than anything. Like, oh, I know it's not working, but it lets me, virtue signal to my friends. So I want to go around screaming Trump's a racist because it makes it look like I'm not racist. If I'm accusing other people of a witch, I can't be a witch because see here I it's that kind of stuff. And just not looking at the programs and saying, well, has this specific type of welfare worked in the last 25 years, or did it make things worse? It's not something we have to guess about because it's already happened. All you have to do is look at it. And do you want to change that? No, because I like the virtue signal.
I don't think people can address the problems that are painfully visible, or if they do, it just gets lumped in with systemic, institutional, legacy of slavery, Jim Crow, etc. You know, when, as I stated before, a lot of these ills were not the case generations ago.
I thought about using sarcasm since liberals tend to watch like comedy channels and look at Facebook memes for the depth of their entire political understanding. So,
That's it's
could
a funny
we?
assessment, but it's true though.
It is. I was wondering if we're going to have whites 6-year-olds apologize for slavery, should the Japanese as a whole apologize for Yoko Ono? Should the state give an official apology for breaking up the Beatles, or
That's a great point.
because that's a satirical movement I could get behind.
I think that would be an effective way, because, like you just said, and I'm learning this too, I think theatrics works with liberals. It really does. I remember you made a joke. I use this, I run this too. Explaining economics to liberals is like explaining chemistry to 6-year-olds. You know, it really is true. You really might have to use an actual drawing board and use like crayons or markers.
You need puppets. Like, you need like South Park cartoons. You need little things because they just, the snarkiness and arrogance, you have to get through that. And you can't get your foot in the door with these people. But because for them, it's a group identity is just a must. You can't talk
They're
about
on the
individual liberty.
side, like I said, Ben Shapiro used the paradigm. They left. Why do you think leftists side with the worst in humanities? Because they feel they're on the side of angels. They see Che Guevara or Mao Zedong or Pol Pot as fighting the man. You know, they see someone who's, you know, they see a poor person, they think immediately they're poor because someone is rich. They believe in a zero-sum game. So this is why they align with people, you know, the worst of the worst.
Well,
You
you
know,
see, the right
rather.
have the same, not the same, but they have a sense of exceptionalism too, where it's like, oh, we get attacked. It's because they hate our freedom. It couldn't possibly be based on our behavior. It couldn't possibly be because of what we're doing or starving people to death, attacking their countries. Don't let's just start it from reacting to some terrorist attack and not looking at the rampant sanctions and military interventions. And the left Some of them see that, some don't. But when it comes to social issues, oh, they're completely as collectivist and exceptionalist as the right is on their American exceptionalism
But
foreign policy.
with the criticism of militarism, the left throw that out the window for identity, you know?
Oh,
They could
yeah.
have a they could have look, you made the point. Look, you could have had Ron Paul, but now
Yeah.
you get a manifestation of Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton and Donald
And Donald
Trump, you
Trump.
know?
Trump is exactly what you deserve for not voting for Ron Paul twice. You get what's
Trump,
coming.
that you know what? The whole alt-right is just a manifestation against the political correctness.
It's a
And I
reaction
agree
to
with
social justice ninnies. I mean, that's
yeah,
what
I agree
the
with them, I'm
alt-right, you
certain.
deserve it. I think that some of those guys are funny, but that is exactly what you get for your years of your social justice warrior baloney. You know, you reap what you sow.
No, absolutely.
Well, that's a foreign concept to liberals too. You reap what you sow. Well, you earned that? What'd that mean? Privilege?
No, absolutely. You know, and the alt-right, you know, they're on point with the anti-social justice. Milo's pretty entertaining. It's just that when you back Trump so vehemently, his trade
Vehemently.
policy and his economics is just like he just shows his economic illiteracy, you know. Not as bad as Bernie, mind you. My God, that's just a nightmare. But he's still like the rest of them. I look at it as Trump is a wild man. You don't know what you're gonna get. My firm belief is the whole wall thing and then harsh immigration enforcement. I don't think it's really practical because, man, if you go to parts of Texas, it's almost, say, like San Antonio, Houston, which is damn near Mexican. It's very hard to distinguish who was born here and who just got here. You know what I'm saying? It's very, for a bureaucracy to oversee that, it's very, and then the wall and all that and how much it's going to
That's a weak
cost.
point for him, but at least he has the sense to not arm Al Qaeda groups in Syria. I mean, we're talking about really basic stuff. Like any little kid would be like, "Hey, do you think we should kill people? Yes or no?" No. Do you think we should give guns to people who are killing people? No. But our politicians can't see that. Well, if we get these to these moderate rebels who again and again aren't, but they know that. I mean, it's just plausible deniability. The goal is regime change in Syria for the sake of the Israelis, period. I mean, our State Department admitted that. They want to weaken Hezbollah, and they want to drain power from Iran, and they know they can do this by creating this quagmire in Syria. But the
Why do
left,
you
again, they can't see any of that. They can't see the Office of Special Plans behind the Iraq War. It has to be as simplistic as we did it for oil, because it's got to be rich white guys that started this war. Well, no, it was a cabal of neoconservatives, mostly Jewish, who wanted, with a Zionist ideology, writing specific policy papers and deceptions, fabrications, not miscalculations or incompetence, but straight up intentional lies to start a war in Iraq. That's what actually happened, and they just ignore that and say it's oil.
You know, that's the thing, a vague platitudes, it's very simplistic. That's what it comes down to. Nothing ever has to get contested, and that falls in that category. You know, your work and that has been truly phenomenal. You're the first person to put me onto that. I think Israeli influence as a whole is just something that eludes a lot of people.
And yet, you'll see, there are a lot of people who can say they can get it, like, at least since the more recent bombings of Gaza. I don't mean yesterday, because they bombed Gaza yesterday, but even more, like, the
A
previous
year
few
ago.
campaigns a couple years ago, a year ago, CAS led, Operation Pillar of God, those, you did start to see the media say, gosh, that really is wrong to blow up a hospital. Gosh, it's wrong what's happening to Gaza for a couple weeks, and then it fades away. But you will see people on the left, because it is brown people getting killed, that they go, wait, this fits in my paradigm. Isn't that bad? Aren't they being oppressed? But then they do this Bernie Sanders thing. Well, what would you do with 3,000 rockets every day? Which is not the whole,
Shut up! I have the microphone. Remember
yeah.
that.
Don't yell. It's like, well, he's yelling because he doesn't have a microphone.
For the viewers, Ryan did a video on Bernie Sanders. He grabbed a clip of he was speaking at some speaking
A
engagement,
town hall meeting.
a town hall meeting, and I think he brought up the whole Gaza siege, and an individual had come to the aid of Palestinians, saying, "What would you do if you're being ethnically cleansed?" And Bernie literally with a microphone is yelling at the guy, and the guy doesn't have a microphone. His response is, "Shut up! I got the microphone." You know.
Yeah. Shut up! I'm gonna answer it. He does acknowledge that. Oh, he's like, it's kind of like, oh yeah, Palestinians have some plight, and we need to fix that. But, and then just goes right into the whole Hamas charter and all the standard Hasbara talking points.
Yeah.
That you hear over and over again on any TV channel you can click on. You know, I hope, I don't know if you're going to be free or not. I know it's far from Louisiana, but this August, the goal is to go down to Los Angeles and screen this film, Occupation of the American Mind, which gets into the televised propaganda, the Hasbara, and how effective it has been in painting this conflict. There are a lot of people, even college age, what do they call them? Babysitting services. Oh, no, wait, colleges. People in college saying they not what they thought, but Jolly asked them, just write down what you know. So this is what they believe they knew. And they said the Palestinians were occupying the Israelis. They had everything backwards. And that's something they had enough confidence to say they knew about the conflict.
Mm-hmm.
The college is not going to mean anything anymore with the way it's going. So you went to college, so okay, you avoided the real world for as long as possible. It's just really sliding, but we've gone over the hour mark, so I'm going to let you go, and we can pick up these topics again. Weren't you going on someone's show here shortly?
I plan to. I just have to get my equipment up. A gentleman by the name of Tommy Sotomayor, some of your viewers may know who he is. I've been on his show routinely. We've had long just as you and I are doing, we had long conversations on race, culture, and economics. For those of you not familiar with Tommy, he's an African-American male. He elaborates on his subculture. He makes fun of African-American women, the subculture amongst them, the ghetto culture, and its counterproductive trends by covering news clips with humor. He also has a radio show. I've been on his show, and he wants to have me on. He's, you know,
he's serious, but he's funny also. So,
yeah, he's serious and he's funny.
He has enough humor that you could get a Democrat to listen to it for a few minutes.
Oh, my God, no. Yeah, I think your liberal friend would probably get violent and jump you like they like to do when someone disagrees with them. They can't come up with an argument. They have to get violent.
Yeah, it's mic drop. I won. Don't. Yeah. This is how a liberal argues, with two fingers in their ears.
And but I plan on being on, you know, I'm going to put a message out there. I expressed it to some individuals, Talib Starks and others, is that I think the topic of race has dominated the airwaves for a while. And I don't think people have given a proper assessment. Like many things, that we just have vague assertions or foregone assumptions. Nothing has ever really been contested. And there are people, you know, this is not the days of William F. Buckley's program or Milton Friedman, Free to Choose, where you had an open floor. It's becoming increasingly difficult. So I'm going to propose the idea.
Hold on. I want to bring up one thing before, because I don't know how this didn't come up, because other people in the comments are going to be screaming about it. Aren't there some intrinsic differences, like if you look at the bell curve statistics of IQ rates, where some groups are just lower than others? I mean, can that be explained away by government or cultural problems, or?
Yeah. Well, no. Great question. IQ, mental test scores. This is a very prominent thing. One of the most prominent examples is the World War I test scores for blacks and Jews, and how they were lagging behind. But then, by World War II, you saw that these groups had a spike in IQ differences. The Eastern European Jews. Who came here during that time, during World War I, in record numbers, they came from households where English wasn't spoken, so they were lagging behind. And then, of course, you look at World War II, by that time, their IQs had skyrocketed. You know, many people pontificate it was because of the Jewish culture of having a reverence for learning wherever they went, you know, where they were the minorities. So let's say New York, for example, having a free public library was a gold mine, you know, and they seized upon it, and they ended up dominating academia to the point where, you know, in the academic world, they had a limitation on how many Jews were allowed in, just as the case is blacks. But furthermore, it is a very, just as everything we discuss is very nuanced and complex, because if you look at, let's say New York City is the melting pot. You have children of different ethnicities, different races, side by side in the same classrooms, in the same schools, with parents in the same neighborhoods and similar occupational backgrounds, having differentials in IQs bigger than that between blacks and whites in the Jim Crow South. The question is, what is the factor in that? And there's a
the same family, you have brothers and sisters with drastically different success rates in business or whatever stick you want to measure, and IQ too, with very similar genetics.
Yeah, very similar genetics. And you take I forgot the gentleman's name. He mentioned it, intellectuals and race. Ah, I forgot the two professors who did the profound studies. But you notice that the culture also played into that. Let's say like black families, black military families whose parents were stationed overseas in Germany, who went to schools with predominantly white children, they had higher IQs than the average black in the U.S. stateside. You know, so it's not genetic. The whole notion of genetic determinism was just thoroughly discredited. You had very prominent people like Madison Grant and Richard Eli who believed in genetic determinism.
But the belief is that IQ is independent because it's just your potential to learn. It's not really about how poor you are or not. But it seems to be that, and this is something I'll throw out there, because I have a relative that teaches at a school. It's about 60% black, 40% white. And this is what these kids do when they are given IQ tests or any tests. They answer it as fast as possible, throw it out, and want to go outside because they don't care. So it's just, if it's, they have to think about it too much, it's A, C. It doesn't matter to them. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how accurate it is because not everyone's taking that so seriously. When you're giving IQ tests in school, they just want to go to recess. They just answer whatever. This isn't a grade? No? Oh, I'll just write whatever I want then and get out of here.
That's a culture who really doesn't care much about education, you know? And that leads you to believe, what does their parents advocate for? Do their parents really care, you know? It's not a genetic thing. The plight of parents, let's say black parents in inner cities who may not be the most affluent, but they want to utilize the voucher program or tuition tax credit to send their kid to a school, but they're met by barriers from local governments or federal. You know, there was a case in 2013 of parents in Chicago who wanted to utilize the voucher program. Barack Obama gave a half-assed rebuttal to it, something of diversity. But it's funny, those individuals who practice, those politicians who can't find...
Diversity is a cult too, because it's not really a diversity of opinion, it's just a diversity of genetics.
Yeah, or a diversity of racial composition.
That's useless. Yeah. They're all, I wonder how many conservative gender studies teachers there are or something. I don't know. But anyway, I got to go, but I appreciate your time. I do want to circle this back. You had one more point you were making before I jumped in with the IQ, and I'm sorry for that, but that is something that always comes up, and I thought I'd start explaining it. And I like to talk about IQ some more later, but do you remember? I hope I didn't make you forget, but do you remember what you were saying before I got into that?
Oh, I'm just saying is that the politicians who stifle school choice for children are the same ones who can't find public schools good enough for their own children. So it's just hypocrisy right there.
Hey, we got to ban guns, but I get armed bodyguards.
I get bulletproof cars and escorts everywhere, yeah.
Yeah, and I give guns to cartels and Al-Qaeda groups.
Yeah, absolutely.
Unbelievable. I hope Hillary Clinton chokes on a Trump steak.
With that. The fact that this woman can even have a platform, Ryan, like, you don't have to be an investigative journalist to really dig deep and find the dirt. You know, it's so opaque. It's right there, you know.
But she has a vagina.
Yeah, because I didn't. And then, you know what's even worse? When you take like an economic or political analysis, just the stuff of doing rap moves, or she was doing the nene, whatever that stupid dance is, or she was going to like New York trying to swipe a subway card and hang out in people's apartments in Spanish Harlem. This woman has not driven herself in like 20 years. Not even joking, not exaggerating. She has not driven herself in over 20 years.
She'd get lost in a supermarket. What are these? I had a relative who was her bodyguard for a long time, and I have some stories, but I'll save that for another time. She is truly disgusting. That's the best word for that.
What Trump promises in disreputable language, she's actually put into policy. That's the funny thing.
All the most offensive stuff he's ever said, she's done.
Yeah, that's the funny thing.
But he's Hitler, because John Oliver. Right.
Emotional child's guide to political discussion. What Trump promises in disreputable language, she's actually put into policy. That's the funny thing.
All the most offensive stuff he's ever said, she's done.
Yeah, that's the funny thing.
But he's Hitler, because John Oliver. Right.
Emotional child's guide to political discussion.
Johnny Benchcon. See you.
All right, man. All right, later.